Well, I don't know if you're planning any Christmas get-togethers, maybe with the sort of wider family, people you don't often see, or maybe with work colleagues. Well, if you want to keep things harmonious, avoid discussions about religion or politics. That's the advice that people often give about these situations. That's the case, at least in sort of traditional British culture. I mean, I'm not sure that's true, actually, for places from other cultures. I don't know. You can maybe tell me about that later. So this idea, you shouldn't talk about religion and politics. But another aspect of British and indeed Western culture is to keep religion and politics separate, independent of one another. Very different, for example, to Islam. So, you know, we're hearing about France a few weeks ago. You see that great separation of church and state in France, and also you get it in the United States. You actually get it as well in Britain, but in a typically sort of perverse British way of doing things, that just as, you know, in Britain you have public schools that are actually private schools, so you sort of say the opposite of what you mean. In the same way, you keep the church and state separate by having a state church in Britain. That's how it's done. So you have a church that is seen in sort of fancy dress in national events, but almost that is there in that sort of public view precisely so you can avoid it the rest of the time. For example, you never hear a government saying, you know, what does God say about this issue? You know, what can we find out from God to help us on this? Or maybe we should be praying about this problem. That's what I mean about that there's no connection between church and state. Okay, you just don't get that. So yes, there's a national church, but there's no practical impact on what is actually going on politically. Well, think now to what was going on in first century Israel. There you have a deeply religious culture, led by the high priests, but you have the political power that is in the hands of the Romans. And by and large, these two groups try to sort of live alongside each other, staying out of each other's business. So Pilate would focus on the politics, keeping Rome happy, keeping the peace, and he doesn't want to get drawn into a sort of religious debate. It's what you find here in verse, you know, 31. You know, take him yourselves, judge him by your own law. You know, I don't want to be bothered with this. I want to stay out of it. And yet, ironically, Pilate ends up having a discussion with the Son of God, no less, about God's kingdom and the nature of truth. You can't really get more religious than that. Pilate, the politician. And on the other hand, you've got the religious leaders becoming politicians. They're very clever in how they talk about the threat of Jesus. They portray Jesus as being a threat to Rome. And if you read on into chapter 12, they say, you know, chapter 19 in verse 12, they say, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. They're being very political. And I think what's going on here is neither Pilate nor the religious leaders really know how to handle Jesus. This question of what do I do with Jesus? He just doesn't quite fit. He is not religious in the way that they are used to, and he is not political in the way that Pilate is used to. And yet that doesn't mean he's sort of irrelevant. Rather, he's someone that can't be ignored because he disrupts both. He subverts both the religion of the chief priests and the politics of Pilate. And Pilate here is just desperate to avoid dealing with Jesus, avoiding a decision about him. You know why at the end of the chapter there he puts the decision back out to the crowds? He doesn't want to have to do something with Jesus, and yet he can't avoid it. And in that, I think Pilate is like what we are like, naturally. Jesus is someone awkward. He's someone uncomfortable. He doesn't quite fit, and we would prefer to ignore him. Certainly, the real Jesus We might be happy to have a sort of a Jesus of our own invention, but the Jesus we actually find here in Scripture, we would rather ignore and maybe just get on with our lives. You know, let's get back to lunch. Let's get back to the plan for the week. I don't really want too much to do with this Jesus. He's too uncomfortable. Well, the overall lesson for today is that you can't ignore Jesus. Just as Pilate was forced to do something with him, it's the same for us. We have to do something with Jesus. He is controversial. He does create conflict. All through his ministry, Jesus was constantly creating conflict. There was endless discussion about what do you do with this guy? Who is he? How should you respond to him? And, you know, in the era of peace and goodwill to all men, listen to what Jesus says. Do you think I came to bring peace on the earth? No, he says, I tell you, but division. From now on, there will be five in one family divided against each other. Three against two, two against three. They will be divided, father against son, son against father, mother against daughter, daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. Quite a Christmas gathering, isn't it? And there's that division around Jesus. You can have close family ties, but there can be a division around Jesus. So yes, Jesus would seem to be on trial here. But in fact, the people really on trial, it's Pilate who is on trial. It's the religious leaders who are on trial. He exposes his enemies. And just as they are on trial as they confront Jesus, so are we this morning. It's about our response to him. So let's look first of all at this sort of inner conflict that's going on in these different groups. First of all, the Jewish leaders. They were the driving force behind Jesus' arrest and execution. And yet they need the help of the Romans. They needed had the Roman soldiers there in the arrest, and now they need Pilate's help for the death penalty. Verse 31, we have no right to execute anyone. They need Pilate to authorize that. And that puts them in a bit of a conflict because they hated Pilate. As we're about to see, he was a real enemy of the Jews. They hated him, but they needed him. And it's clear they must already have spoken to him about Jesus. The way Pilate comes along with this charge about being a king indicates that they've already spoken to him, which is what we find in the other Gospels. And the Jewish leaders here are just very frustrated by Pilate. You know, he comes and says, you know, what charges are you bringing? And they say, well, look, if he wasn't a criminal, we wouldn't have brought him to you. It's a bit of a sort of sullen and quite sort of risky reply, really. They basically expected Pilate, you know, it's like going with a bit of paper saying, look, just sign here, okay? Look, don't worry about what it is, just sign it and we'll be done. That's what they wanted him to do, just sign it off. But Pilate insists on almost having his own trial. And so they have to engage with Pilate further. And although they hated him, they hated the Roman rule, yet in their desire to see Jesus killed, they end up saying in chapter 19, verse 15, they say, we have no king but Caesar. That's quite a statement, isn't it, for these Jewish leaders? But that's what they're driven to in this conflict they're in. And also, the chief priests and other religious leaders wouldn't have supported the zealots that were sort of involved in an armed uprising against the Romans. They wanted to keep the Romans sort of on side. And yet, what do their actions lead to? Their actions lead to the releasing of exactly that sort of person, a terrorist, Barabbas, who is actually guilty of the very things they accuse Jesus of. You see the conflict and contradiction. And then there's this whole thing about the Passover. Now, the Passover meal would have happened the night before, but the Passover refers to the whole sort of feast. You had days of unleavened bread following that. And that's what it's talking here about them being worried about eating the Passover. They didn't want to get into the Roman palace. They didn't want to become ritually unclean so they could eat the Passover. They were bothered by that, and yet they weren't bothered by an unjust trial leading to the execution of an innocent man. That's quite a contradiction. But before we're too quick to point the finger, it's a contradiction that can be found in every one of us. We can be very particular about certain moral issues. And yet, if we are not trusting Jesus, we are guilty of the greatest act of rebellion against God. There's that contradiction in all of us. And there's a contradiction and a conflict in Pilate. He was the Roman governor. Now, normally he would be staying away from Jerusalem in the headquarters in Caesarea. But during times like the Passover, when there were big festivals, he would often be there in the capital. And he had his own sort of fortress near the temple. But Pilate here is not in control of events. Now, he's someone who was very brutal. You get a hint of that in Luke's gospel. He talks about people having been killed while offering sacrifices by Pilate. And there's lots of other accounts of things that Pilate did in the sort of Roman records and stuff of his brutality. And he was also someone who was pretty anti-Semitic. He hated Jews. So that comment he makes in verse 35, you know, am I a Jew? He was expressing disdain for this people. You know, don't associate me with these people. And he was someone that liked to provoke the Jews. He would deliberately do things they would find offensive, particularly to do with their religious practices. And so here in this whole account, Pilate has no interest in justice. But he, in a sense, wants this trial to basically annoy the Jews. You know, they want him just to sign this off. And he's wanting to say, well, actually, no, I am in charge here, guys. You know, I'll let me have my own little trial. I'll make my own independent judgment. And yet, what does he do? He ends up totally going along with the Jewish leaders. When he asks, am I a Jew? Well, he acted just like them. So why was such a brutal and ruthless man so weak in this situation? Well, it makes sense if we understand these events as happening in AD 33. There's sort of a debate over, you know, was this AD 30 or AD 33? And I think the evidence very much points towards AD 33. And this helps to explain why Pilate behaves as he does. Here's a bit of Roman history for you. Okay, Pilate had been appointed as the governor in Judea by a guy called Sejanus, who was in effect a sort of number two to the emperor Tiberius. But the emperor Tiberius sort of took sort of early retirement. He seemed to sort of get a bit fed up with running the empire and basically sort of went off to, I think, to an island somewhere and sort of took a step back from looking after things. And so Sejanus basically took over. And Sejanus had a real hatred for the Jews. And he used Pilate to fulfill that sort of policy. The problem was, in AD 31, Tiberius started to realize what was going on and realized that Sejanus was actually a bit of a threat. And Sejanus ends up getting executed. So think what this means for Pilate. His backer has gone. He is now in a very weak position with Caesar, because if he was a friend of Sejanus and Sejanus was seen as plotting against Caesar, then Pilate's going to be in the firing line. So you can see this charge that the Jews make, you know, about being a friend of Caesar was very, 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 very powerful. And Tiberius was someone who was actually much more favorable towards the Jews. He wanted to avoid trouble and would try and accommodate them. So now Pilate's rather conflicted. Releasing Jesus would provoke trouble. So Pilate has an innocent man executed to save his own skin. The cost of choosing Jesus was too high. And I wonder, is that the case for you? The Jewish leaders and Pilate were conflicted. Jesus wasn't. See, Jesus was the one here paying the price for the hatred of the Jewish leaders, for the cowardice of Pilate. He was the prisoner. And yet, he's the one that seems to be in control of events here. There is an incredible calm authority about Jesus. Jesus is on trial, and yet it is Jesus who really asks the questions. Jesus controls the conversation. This wasn't quite the agenda Pilate had in mind. It's Jesus's agenda. And in fact, this is something we see all through Jesus's life. Even at age 12 with his parents, he never is backed into a corner. He never lets himself be on trial. He's never emotionally manipulated. You can't put Jesus on trial. Not even his parents could. And it's the same for us today. Jesus asks the questions. So often we go to judge Jesus, or, you know, I'm not sure I agree with you on this, Jesus. There's not enough evidence, Jesus. That's not a good enough answer, Jesus. But we can't do that because we are the ones on trial. And Jesus insists that we know the truth about him. When he says here to Pilate, verse 34, is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about me? He insists that Pilate doesn't just accept some second-hand garbled account from people who don't know him. You need to know Jesus for yourself. So don't accept what other people say about Jesus, be they RE teachers, bishops, or podcasters. Go to Jesus himself. Go to his words. That's how you know the truth. And in Jesus, there is no conflict. See, Pilate was trying to work out what was in his own self-interest. Jesus wasn't. Now, Jesus felt the horror, the agony of what he was going to be going through. He was not a sort of robot. And yet he was single-minded in doing what was right, in doing what he'd chosen to do out of love, doing what he promised. We're told that through being crucified, Jesus' words were being fulfilled in verse 32. He'd already spoken about the kind of death he was going to die. The normal Jewish form of execution was stoning. But Jesus talks about being lifted up, a reference to crucifixion. And I think a deep symbolism in that crucifixion. You see, you're lifted up on a cross, and here is the God-man stretched between earth and heaven. He's stretched there, connecting earth and heaven with his arms outstretched to humanity. There's a symbolism in the cross. And it creates a conflict for us. What do we do with a crucified Jesus? And what I want to do is look at the two issues Jesus raises here in his trial, that Jesus raises in his trial, that are actually outworkings of him going to the cross. And they really put the focus on us on having to decide what to do with Jesus. First of all, there's this question of what sort of a kingdom are we talking about? See, Pilate knew all about kingdoms and kingship. He was part of the greatest empire the world had ever seen. And yet Jesus is talking about a kingdom that would outgrow and outlast the Roman Empire. Jesus here, the prisoner, that's his kingdom. He would outlast Pilate. So Jesus' kingdom, what's the nature of this kingdom? See, Jesus doesn't answer Pilate's question directly about being a king, because what Pilate understands by king is going to be very different to what the sort of king that Jesus is. And so he insists on answering this question in his own terms, that Pilate understands the type of kingdom that he is a king of. And one very obvious distinction is that it's not a kingdom of violence. It's not a kingdom that's sustained by force. He says in verse 36, you know, my kingdom is not of this world. We'll come back to that. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest. And then you think, but hang on a minute, we've just been told that that's exactly what happened. Peter did fight to try and resist Jesus' arrest. So how could Jesus make this claim? Well, he could make this claim because of something we're told in Luke's gospel. This is a lovely example of where the gospel accounts tie together. One of these sort of undesigned coincidences we've talked about before. Because in Luke's account, we are told that the servant who had his ear cut off was healed by Jesus. You couldn't have a greater demonstration of commitment to non-violence than that. Not only does he condemn Peter for his actions, he actually undoes Peter's actions. This is not a kingdom of violence. Because it's not a kingdom of this world. My kingdom is not of this world, Jesus says. It is not literally from here. Now, this is a phrase that's often been misunderstood. Jesus is not saying, my kingdom is spiritual. It's got nothing to do with the physical world. It's in some sort of separate compartment. It's a bit like how people tend to think of Christianity today. You know, that's just something private for you, totally unconnected to the real world. That is not what Jesus is saying. It can't be, because where did this gospel begin? The Son of God becomes flesh. He becomes part of this world. He does miracles of his kingdom in this world. And what does he tell us to pray? Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. This is a kingdom that has a place on earth. So what Jesus is saying here is that it is a different kind of kingdom to the kingdoms of this world. See, world in John's gospel doesn't refer so much to the planet as to the whole created order that's in rebellion against God. It's the sort of world where we try and take God's place and rule over others by force and violence and power. So Jesus is saying, my kingdom is not just another in the sort of list of human empires. So, you know, the Romans took over from the Greeks. Jesus isn't saying, and I'm just going to be the next empire after the Romans. That's not what he's saying. And I think that's where we need to be thoughtful as Christians. Because you see, as Christians, we should be involved in the political process as citizens of earthly kingdoms. We have that particular privilege, actually, in democracy. But we need to understand that, for example, overthrowing the government is never a sort of final answer or a final goal. Because any government you replace a government with will also be flawed in one way or another. It might be flawed in a different way to the government you got rid of. But it's like when you have revolutions in countries and people think, oh, this will be a new dawn. But the next government often have some of the same problems as the one that went before. I mean, even the situation in South Africa at the moment, I think that, you know, the previous president was in trouble because of corruption, and, oh, let's get rid of the new that president, we got another one. The new one is also embroiled in a corruption scandal. So it's always going to be rather limited and temporary what can be achieved simply in those political terms. Jesus' kingdom is different because it's not an alternative government. It's a sort of alternative society that's embedded within the world. It's something, and you get this in Jesus' parables, it's something sort of hidden, it's something unnoticed, it's something actually very subversive. Christians are too often reactionary rather than subversive. There's a few messages behind that. So, for example, in churches, the churches are places that should reflect Jesus' rule. We should be like an alternative society. You know, if we are concerned about different issues in society, well, we should show, if you like, how things should be done in the church. If we're concerned about racism in society, let's make sure that we have a church where that there's no hint of racism, and indeed the very opposite of drawing people together in their differences. We're an alternative society. We're a place of self-giving because we're reflecting the self-giving sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. It's a community of love, not of power. So the church is in the world, but we live by a different standard to the world. There's lots more that could be said. But understand a sort of subtext going on here. Jesus here is reclaiming the kingdom of Adam, the first human. You see, Adam was given the task of ruling over the world that God had made. We get it in Psalm 8. This is the task that God has given to human beings, not to angels. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet. The problem is, Adam sinned. Adam did that in the wrong way. And all of us have followed that since. So our rule over the world is an oppressive rule. A rule where the strong overpower the weak. A rule where there's suffering and death. A kingdom a bit like the sort of thing Pilate was running. Jesus' kingdom is different. You see it all going in reverse. So when Jesus comes and when he announces his kingdom, what happens? It's not disease enters, disease exits. The miracles of the kingdom are healing the sick, raising the dead, bringing freedom, not oppression. He's undoing the damage of Adam. He's putting history in reverse. And that's seen in the ultimate way by going to the cross. He is dying and rising again to bring forgiveness, a new life, and one day a new creation for those who will follow him. You could say that surely Jesus is sort of a king anyway. Jesus is God. And at one sense, Pilate is under Jesus' rule because he is God. God rules over everything, even those who do not submit to him. But he is a king in another way. He is going to the cross as the Messiah, as the God-man, who is bringing in a kingdom on behalf of all who trust him. He's bringing in a kingdom for his people. And that kingdom is a kingdom that is always growing. He talks about it filling the earth. It's a kingdom that is eternal. It's a kingdom that outlasted the Roman Empire and will outlast every empire. That's why you can't ignore Jesus. See, you might say, well, look, I've got my life and I'll leave Jesus out of it. But that is a bit like being on the beach and having a bit of the beach. You put your towel down, you're claiming as yours. As the tide comes in, the tide will win. That isn't your bit of beach. And here you're sort of living on Jesus's territory. You can say, well, I'm going to have my bit of life and I'm going to keep Jesus out of it. Well, Jesus is going to claim it one day. His kingdom is advancing like the tide coming up the beach. And one day he'll take it from you. So it matters what you do with Jesus. You may not want to have to think about him, but you can't avoid thinking about him because he's got this kingdom that is going to take over this world. It matters what you do with Jesus. And it's a kingdom of truth. Pilate ends this conversation with this statement, "What is truth?" Which is not a sort of essay title. Pilate isn't about to launch into an investigation of different philosophers of what they thought about truth or something. It was a dismissal. It was a flippant comment to end the discussion. He's not interested in truth. He's only interested in power. As you read this account, it's clear that Pilate didn't really dispute that Jesus was innocent. The problem was it was a sort of disposable fact. That was an inconvenient truth that got in the way of Pilate holding on to power. So you have this conflict between truth and power. And that's why leaders will go into such lengths to control the news, to control what people understand is true. And once you start trying to control that, you're going to need power. You see, if you're going to deny truth, you need to use power to suppress it. You see it in Russia, you see it in China, but you also see it in our own culture. We're in a society of advanced truth decay, a post-truth society. No agreed truth, particularly on moral issues. See, truth is individual. It's what is true for you. Sounds very liberating, doesn't it? Sounds very, that will reduce conflict. It actually does the exact opposite. Because if something is true for you, and it's purely what you think, how do you get anyone else to agree with you? How do you get them to fit in with what you want? You can't appeal to some outside standard and say, well, this is what is true. We all know that. It doesn't exist in this thinking. It's just what's in you. So how do you get other people to fit in with what you want? Through power. You need power. And it's not simply through the sword. It's not simply through violence. There's lots of ways of having power. It can be about who you let speak, who you will cancel, who controls social media. It can be about, power can come from victimhood. Who has the greatest victim status? That gives you a power. Or the greatest celebrity status. Or the greatest financial power. There's lots of ways of exerting power and control. This is how Tim Keller put it in the parliamentary prayer breakfast in 2018. Speaking to a lot of politicians, this is brilliant. He said, when modern people, certainly modern people who talk about human rights and human equality, when we talk to people who don't share our values, all we can do is yell. And he's spot on. All you can do is shout. It's exactly what you're seeing at the World Cup. That's exactly what is happening. We are shouting because there's people that think in a different way. And it's really, I think, a modern form of colonialism. Jesus' kingdom is different. In Jesus, we see the power of truth. What does he say to Pilate? He says, for this reason I was born. For this reason I came into the world. How do you think Jesus would complete that sentence? Why Jesus came into the world? Well, he completes it in a very unexpected way here, to testify to the truth. Clearly the truth mattered to Jesus. And in a way, this statement, to testify to the truth, is a bit of an understatement. Jesus is underplaying, really, his role here. Because it's not simply that what he says is true. Amazing and wonderful as that is, I mean, to think of there's someone whose word we can totally trust, that is always true, that is never, slightly off beam on the truth. I mean, that is pretty of something amazing, isn't it? But it's more than that. It's not simply that what he says was true. His very person is truth. He is reality, if you like. He is the one who is ultimately dependable, faithful. Truth is not a philosophy. Truth is a person. Hence, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I've been really struggling out how you can sort of get this across, really, the wonder and the depth of what Jesus is saying here. Jesus is authentic. He's not some sort of virtual reality or deep fake. He is the real thing. I don't know if you heard Matt Hancock on I'm a Celebrity, but he talked about, you know, why he'd gone on there. He said something like, I wanted to show who I am. Sort of, you know, that this is the real me. And there's that desire, isn't there, for sort of authenticity today. The problem is, none of us do ever show who we really are. We're always putting on some sort of front. There is always something that is hidden and covered about us, but not with Jesus. He is authentic. Jesus is the true humanity. He is the true humanity we are meant to be. And Jesus is also, in the one person, the true God. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So if you want to know the truth about God, look at Jesus. Know Jesus. And just to sort of finish off here, just two very quickly ways that we see that Jesus is the truth. We see it in that he is the creator. It's something we keep coming back to. Everything that exists, everything that is real, exists by Jesus's power. Think back to what we were saying earlier with the children. He creates truth. We can't do that, but when Jesus says something, it happens. So if I drop this, it falls to the ground. Why does it do that? It's not gravity, ultimately. It's because Jesus says so. It is because it is his it is his universe. It is his creation. All of reality is found in him. Why do you get in a mess if you disobey God? Because you're denying reality. You're denying the way that he has made this world. His truth is everywhere. Hence, you can't escape from truth because you can't escape from Jesus. You can't ignore him. So we see him as the truth in creation. Everything exists through Jesus. But we also see it in the cross. Why is Jesus going to the cross? Well, he's going to the cross to bear witness to the truth. In going to the cross, he's bearing witness to the truth that lies matter. And the fact that we as sinners live a lie. When we live a life that is trying to ignore God, trying to live independently of God, we are living a lie. And Jesus is saying that matters. And it leads to death. And so he takes that death upon himself on the cross. He's showing that truth matters in that sense, the truth of who we are meant to be. But in going to the cross, he is also showing that power is not the truth. The truth is not about power. Truth is not about who has the biggest voice or the most money or the highest social media profile. Because in the cross, Jesus is weak. And the truth rather bears witness not to power, but to love. When Jesus dies on the cross, he is naked. There is nothing to hide, nothing to be ashamed of. We see Jesus as he really is. We see who God really is. Jesus says when he goes to the cross, he will be glorified. That's an astonishing statement, that the cross is the place of his glory. That must mean that the cross is the place where we see Jesus as he is in his sort of fullest sense. We see the real thing, his real character. We see who God is really like on the cross. That he is someone who gives his life for his enemies. He is the one who is the servant. He takes the place, he gives his life for his enemies. Seeing just graphically here, in that Jesus dies, so Barabbas goes free. That's the exchange of the cross. That is the sort of God that we have. That is his character displayed. That is the truth. That is the truth that rules this universe. It is not the power of Putin or anyone else. It is the truth of Jesus Christ. So we're back to this question. You see, Pilate asks, what is truth? There's such an irony in that, because truth in all its fullness is standing in front of him. You couldn't have more truth than that, standing in front of Pilate, and Pilate saying, well, what's truth? He's blind to it. What about you? What will you do with this Jesus? Again, we're the ones on trial, not Jesus. Like Pilate, we have to make a decision about him. We will divide around him. If truth is a person, then our response to truth must be personal. And you can't say, oh, I love the truth, and reject Jesus. You can only have the truth with Jesus. That's the choice we have. We either live a lie or we follow Jesus. That's the choice. That's the option. Read later on the quote on the back of the back of the sheets to see how that is worked out in real life. But with Jesus reveals the truth about ourselves, our need, our sin. He reveals the truth about God, of his judgment and his grace. He reveals the truth of salvation that is found in the cross of Jesus. Pilate was trapped by his own insecurity. The Jews were trapped by their own hatred and blindness. Jesus, the prisoner, was free. And he offers that freedom to you. That verse we began with. If you know the truth, know Jesus, the truth will set you free. That's a lot better than what Pilate or anyone else can offer. You know Jesus, you know the truth. That truth will set you free.